Our mission is to bring you an unbiased discussion on the technological development and application of unmanned aerial systems in our airspace. UAS Today.
Welcome to another episode of UAS Today, a show dedicated to the sharing of all information on the integration of unmanned aerial systems into our national airspace. Don't forget you can check us out at uas-today.com. You can also follow us on iTunes, Twitter, and on Facebook. We've got a very special guest today with us, Mr. Dennis Zach Zachlin. Mr. Zachlin is the Deputy Director of New Mexico State University's Unmanned Aircraft Systems Flight Test Center. Mr. Zachlin established the original New Mexico State University Unmanned Aerial System Flight Operations Team in 2004. The primary focus of the UAS flight team was to develop procedures for unmanned aerial systems to fly in our national airspace with manned aircraft. Mr. Zachlin was one of the principal elements in establishing NMSU's Physical Science Laboratory as one of the nation's leaders in unmanned aerial systems. His efforts led to the establishment of the only FAA-authorized UAS-FTC in February of 2007 in the National Airspace System. Since that time, NMSU has worked closely with the Federal Aviation Administration to refine airworthiness and flight operations standards operating procedures to address all advances in software, hardware, and capabilities of unmanned aerial systems. Currently, the six new congressionally directed UAS test sites are using a version of their SOP. Mr. Zachlin has been with New Mexico State University since 2003, following a distinguished career in the U.S. Navy, retiring as a Master Chief Cryptologist. He has an extensive knowledge and experience with unmanned aerial systems, and we are lucky to have him on the show today. Stay tuned.
Support and funding for this podcast has been made possible by the Vodnoy Group. The Vodnoy Group, supporting arts and culture through charitable donations. If you or your company would like to sponsor an episode of UAS Today, please contact us at podcast@uas-today.com.
My guest today is Mr. Dennis Zach Zachlin of New Mexico State University. Dennis, thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
Michael, I'm happy to be here. This is an important thing that you're doing because the public just needs a little bit more education to understand unmanned aircraft systems.
Thank you very much, Dennis. I appreciate that. You're right. This is an important thing that we're trying to do here. Public awareness about the use of unmanned aerial systems is very important. And I, as we always say on our podcast, an informed opinion, whether it be pro or con, the use of unmanned aerial systems in the national airspace for commercial research and hobbyists is still the right opinion. So thank you again for doing this with us. When did New Mexico State University first start working with unmanned aerial systems?
Well, Michael, back in 1998, when the Air Force came out with the Global Hawk 737 wingspan jet UAS, they needed a way to get it up to altitude because it flies above the airspace system, but it has to go through it to get there. New Mexico State University, because we did high altitude ballooning, so we did special use airspace not only in various parts of the U.S., but really 51 different locations all over the world. A Mr. Glenn Witt, who used to run the Albuquerque Service Center, was in our employ at that time, and he was the one that assisted DOD in creating all the procedures and the air routes and how to do this safely, because you're taking, for the first time, an unmanned aircraft system that is huge and taking it up through the airspace system. So that was the start, and then PSL decided to make it a business arm or element for our research and support of government facilities. So at that point in time, the focus really became on, at that time, unmanned aerial systems, which has since changed, and there's lots of different names. RPA, remotely piloted aircraft, UAV is still out there. Unmanned aircraft system is the official term as far as the FAA is concerned. But that that got us our start.
Well, it certainly sounds like New Mexico State University has had a lengthy involvement with unmanned aerial systems. So that's fantastic. I'm glad it got started that way. What makes New Mexico State University and the surrounding area a good test site for unmanned aerial systems?
Well, Michael, there's several great features. We like to say we have 375 days of sunshine and great flying weather every year. Really, it's probably only about 330, but that's still not bad for flight test. The other unique thing is because it is New Mexico, you have a very low population density, and most of the population density is in the Albuquerque, the Las Cruces, and the Rio Rancho areas. So consequently, that means even less people out in, I believe we're the fifth largest state. So there's just a lot of airspace with not a lot of users per se. Plus, we're located just west of the one restricted area that goes from ground to space, which is White Sands Missile Range. So consequently, all the air traffic has to go either north or south of it as it's going east and west. So that opens up a pocket with even less commercial air traffic, and that's a big safety feature, that and the fact that there's just not many people on the ground. Plus, as I said, the weather is just fantastic down here, and you can test over a variety of environments. It's not just desert. We actually have water, we have mountains, we have forest. So it just, for the unmanned aircraft systems and the testing, everything is right here except oceans.
Now, you had mentioned just a moment ago about population density. You're absolutely right. That's very important. I know that the public is very concerned about unmanned aerial systems right now based on some of the news coverage that we've seen from it. So having open areas for testing and for flying and things like that, it definitely alleviates some of the public concern. Since New Mexico State got involved with unmanned aerial systems, has there been any type of or any kind of negative attention from the people in the general area when they see them flying around?
Well, Michael, anytime anything new comes about, there is always concern. When New Mexico State actually purchased some unmanned aircraft systems instead of leasing them for demonstrations and such, it was back in 2004. And there was a group of concerned pilots out at the airport that didn't understand UAS. So it had a negative connotation to them, and all they could see was one accident after another accident happening. So after we got set up and we did our first demonstration down there, and we had lots of conversations with all the local pilots, everybody calmed down because it was an education process. Much like you're doing with this podcast, we did face-to-face with the pilots. We invited them up from other area airports, showed them our system, let them have input to us, because input, when you're doing something, is a different set of eyes, a different perspective, and it oftentimes shows you something that maybe you didn't think about. And it has worked real well down there. Even the commercial guys that come in and out of Las Cruces Airport, I mean, if we're up and flying, they come across the CTAF frequency with a cheerful good morning as they're coming in to drop off their UPS, FedEx, or DHL packages. In about 10 years, 11 years that we've been flying down there, we have not had any incidents where a pilot was in danger. And we do a variety of different things. We put out the standard NOTAMs before we fly, but we also send out what we call a safety email. And we send it out to all the air ambulance services, the Army Guard, anybody else in the area that might be an airspace user that wants to know when we're flying, to say, hey, this is when we'll be flying, this is where we'll be flying, and here are the altitudes. And what we found is communication is the key to safety.
You're absolutely correct about that. I agree with you. Communication is key in that situation. We were talking about the general public, but what I hadn't even thought about, and you bring in an excellent point, is pilots and their concern, because they're sharing the air, our airspace, our national airspace, with these machines, with these unmanned aerial systems. And so it's important for them to be involved with this just as much as the general public. It's really great that the general public is aware of what New Mexico State University is doing with the pilots and with their awareness campaign, similar to what we're doing here. So that's really great.
You know, Michael, being out here in this type of community And west of the Mississippi is a little bit different than east of the Mississippi. People out here enjoy their freedoms. They enjoy their solitudes. And yes, it's a concern because you read things in the press, you hear them on radio stations and on TV, and people start developing a perception. Some of the locals in the area have called us and said, you know, were you flying over my property? And it goes back to the educational part of it. Sometimes those phone calls will last an hour and a half. But what you get is you get a better understanding of what the populace is worried about and concerned about. But at the same time, it affords us an opportunity to educate them, and then they educate the people around them. So it starts working out pretty good. And to my knowledge, we have not received, nor has any of the government agencies down here, received any issues with us flying our unmanned aircraft up above them. Because we're primarily looking at research, flight, aeronautical research, and of course the ground. But more the ground for agricultural, desert, you know, mountainous regions, whatever, for care and feeding of the ground.
You know, you bring up another excellent point. Some of the things that we use unmanned aerial systems for that the public is, for the most part, not aware, and that's geological surveys, geographical surveys, things like that. So when we have those sensors on our unmanned aerial systems and we're doing our studies, it's not looking into somebody's backyard. It's not doing this. We're actually doing a lot of scientific work. And it's really good that we bring those things up and make the public aware, make the general public aware of what it is that we're trying to do. What size and type of unmanned aerial systems is your test site capable of accommodating for different testing?
That's interesting. As per the FAA, under our current CRADA, we are authorized, we are not limited to any particular size or unmanned aircraft coming through our flight test center. The smallest we've had was probably a pound and a half, and with less than a 2-foot wingspan. That being said, the largest was coming to us until it was a government program that got cut because the technology wasn't there yet. Was a 400-foot wingspan, 6,500-pound high-flying UAS called Vulture 2 that Boeing was going to be putting together. But due to the fact that the solar panels just couldn't give enough percentage back, there was a weight ratio problem. So the project was shelved until the solar panels got a little bit better. Other than that, we've got people with jets coming down. We have small ones. We have medium-sized ones. And really, it's just a great place to do this.
We were actually fortunate enough to have Jeremy Novara with Vanilla Aircraft on our show a few months ago, and I know that he's planning on coming out to New Mexico State for his testing. And they had a pretty good size aircraft that they're going to be bringing down here, and you know, we wish them the best of luck with what they're going to be doing out here, and their tests go really well. You had mentioned just a moment ago the term CRADA. Would you mind explaining a little bit more to our audience what a CRADA is?
A CRADA, which is a CRDA, is a Cooperative Research and Development Agreement, and that's between the user, in this case us, and the FAA. The FAA provides us with some things, and in this case, what they provided us was authorization to establish and run this Unmanned Aircraft Systems Flight Test Center. And what the FAA gets back in return is data, which they need to develop rules, regulations, and processes, and standards. So it works out to be a mutually beneficial arrangement that doesn't cost the taxpayers any money.
If someone is interested in testing their unmanned aerial system at New Mexico State University and your facility, how do they go about beginning the process?
Well, Michael, we've sort of streamlined it since we started back in 2007 with the FAA. Any particular person or company or group of people that wants to come in and get their UAS assessed from an airworthiness perspective and then perform aeronautical research flights, what they do is they just contact us. And that can be a phone call, that can be an email, that can be us walking down the street. And what we do is we then start the process. And our process is currently being used by the other six UAS test sites because it's semi-automated. The FAA has been used to it because of the CRADA agreement. And, you know, it's not perfect and it's forever changing, but it makes it fairly simple. Once they contact us, we get the general information about the aircraft and the type of testing that they want to do. We send a report into the FAA saying, hey, we have been approached. We plan on taking this through. Do we have your permission? Once that occurs, then we start the contractual type things, and we set them up on our website, which is about behind about five firewalls, because this is proprietary information. It belongs to that person, that company, and we want to make sure that nobody else can get their fingers on it. Once we get them set up on the site, they fill out a questionnaire that we call a systems analysis guide. Empty, it's about 9 pages, single-spaced. And for some of the less technical systems, it may end up being 15 pages. For some of the larger, very technical systems, then that can end up being thousands of pages. And that becomes an iterative process where our analysts or safety analysts are actually looking at the data as it's being put in just to make sure that they understood the questions in the data that we need. Because with new technology like this, it's easy to read something and get sidetracked and then spend hours and hours to find out that that's not what was really needed. So we try and work with them. Then we actually sit down and assess it as a team. And again, it depends. If it's a real small system and not very technical, then that may be 2 people. If it's a large system, that could be 20 people. Because you have to look at each and every subsystem and component to determine, is it safe? Does it marry up? Is it integrated properly? And then how's it going to fly? Then we hold what we call a safety assessment meeting with the proponent, and oftentimes the FAA sits in. We have them brief their system to us. And the reason we do that, a lot of people initially think it's regurgitation. Well, I just provided you all the data in writing. But it goes back to what I said. Sometimes you read a question and you write down the answer to the question and your mind focuses on writing it. Then when you have to brief the question, that comes from a different part of your brain and it spews out, well, this is how I really do it, not how I designed it to be. And what it does is it brings out areas where, oh, okay, now we either understand what you wrote better, or now we have questions and we have to drill down further to make sure that all the pieces fit together on the airworthiness side of things. We also do hazard analysis worksheets, and we do a partial FAA safety management system document that says, here's our findings, here's what we found, here's our mitigations for risk. Because anytime you fly a new aircraft, for testing purposes especially, there are things that can go wrong. Okay, so we really need to do it in a step-by-step fashion. And we put limitations on how they can fly the aircraft and where it's going to be flown, because that's part of the safety assessment. Once that's done, we provide a final report to the FAA with a statement from us that says, this aircraft is airworthy to test fly at New Mexico State University's Unmanned Aircraft Flight Test Center. When the FAA approves, we go out and do the flight testing.
That is a really involved process. I don't think anybody realizes, the general public or people who are involved in unmanned aerial systems that are just getting started and getting into the process, I don't think anybody realizes the steps that are necessary to really get the ball rolling when they want to test a new system. So I'm going to tip my hat once again to Jeremy Novara and Vanilla Aircraft, because we talked in depth about, you know, what they were going through and everything else. And I first met Jeremy at an AUVSI workshop, and as positive as the guy was about it, I don't think, you know, we only barely touched on the subject of what his company has to go through to get his unmanned aerial system up and tested. So that's a very in-depth process.
Jeremy Novara has been talking with us for probably about 5 years, since about the time he and his partner started their company. And they were using CBR money from the government to get started. And He was looking for how to bring it through an airworthiness process. And Jeremy and his team are just fabulous. I guess they've been through part of the NASA's airworthiness process and part of somebody else's. And then they finally settled on coming down to New Mexico State, partly due to what they need, partly due to the fact that we have a lot of experience in this. You know, in the time frame it takes on a small one, it can be as small as 4 hours. And when I say a small UAS, understand that when you go down to Hobby Lobby and you purchase that $60 RC aircraft, because of the laws and the regulations, if you are using that for any commercial purpose, including keeping your own pilots trained up, that is now a UAS. But because that's such a simple system, we can actually take that through that entire process in about 4 hours. And at that point in time, then it can fly underneath our COA. In a case like Jeremy's, it's actually been fairly quick because Jeremy had all the other data from the other processes that he had gone through. So some of it was cut and paste. But yes, Jeremy's aircraft is unique to their company. It's designed for a particular thing. They'll do their initial flight testing down here, and they'll move on to another location.
After someone has completed testing at your facility, what's the next step in the process for those companies?
Is a company goes through the initial testing that they do on a UAS. Most of them are looking to sell it commercially or potentially go use it commercially to perform services. You know, the FAA is working in that direction, and now you have the 333 option for the small UAS for entrepreneurs that want to provide a service or use these commercially for something. So that's one of their options. Some are trying to break into the DOD or the military market. So they'll use our data from the flight test to support their effort and go and sell their product, basically. But we also work with a variety of other federal and state entities, anywhere from DOI, DHS, DOJ, and we'll steer people where we feel that their product might have an opportunity, because our goal is to get unmanned aircraft system safely integrated into the NAS where they need to be, because it's a tool that addresses, as somebody once quoted, the dull, the dangerous, and the dirty functions of manned aircraft. And they do things some manned aircraft can't do, like fly up to a dam and look for cracks in the wall, look for moisture, look for a variety of just different things on any kind of infrastructure. And that's where these will really be a big help to society and the country as a whole.
It's interesting that you touch on that point about, you know, studying the structural integrity of bridges and some of the other things. We've had previous guests on the show internationally, Air Robot. Their interview is actually getting ready to come out. They're based in Germany, and they do testing on wind turbines using unmanned aerial systems, and they study structural integrity of bridges. So it's important for the general public to really be informed about some of the things, the capabilities that these systems are being used for. It's excellent that we have companies domestically here in America that are trying to get off the ground and doing that. I think that that'll be a big improvement for companies here, and as well as safety standards on bridges and things like that. To have unmanned aerial systems that are able to do this is really just fantastic. How many companies have you seen move on to the next stage after being with New Mexico State University and testing?
Well, obviously, each one that has come through moves on, you know, to some degree. But most of them have been successful and moved on. Some of them, as we discussed, had gone internationally, because in the U.S. we're a little bit slower to have the integration done. Plus, some of the companies, you know, they're in business to make money, and they have to pay their salaries. So if they can go to a foreign country, be it a third world nation or whatever, those systems provide a lot of good needed support for those countries, whether it's agriculture, whether it's infrastructure, whether it's pipelines, because if you have a pipeline, you want to know when you have a leak and where it is. Or even better, you want to see that the potential for a leak is coming up and you fix it before the leak occurs, because that way you don't have environmental damage. We worked with a company called Newfields, who is into the extraction game, anything coming out of the ground. And they're an engineering firm, and they took an initial start with a gold mine, but really an open pit mine's an open pit mine. And there's a lot of safety issues. And MSHA, M-S-H-A, which is the mining OSHA, has a lot of regulations. However, it's still a dangerous environment. So Newfields actually took a small UAS and flew the leach fields for mapping purposes, and they got it down to 4 centimeter and less accuracy, which is very important because that's not currently going on at these sites, and it's a very important feature. The other feature on the leach fields is you need to know where the moisture content is, because if the leach field comes down, it falls back into the pit. If there's somebody working down there, then they're dead. But there's other potentials along that line, and that's what Newfields is doing. So you see a lot of different companies now starting to get into the unmanned aircraft systems. The big thing that we try and do with any company that comes to us that wants to start using a UAS is to say, what is your requirement? What is it you want to accomplish? Don't go out and buy the UAS and then figure out what you want to do. Go first, say, I want to look at the high wall of a mine. I want to look at the side of a building for cracks or for leaks of air or heat, depending upon whether you're up north or down south, and those type things. And then you find the sensor, because the sensor is the key. The UAS is a truck, bus, boat, whatever you want to call it. It's a carrier. It carries the sensor. That's the whole reason for it being up there. So you start with, what do I want to accomplish? What sensors do I need? Now, what UAS can carry those sensors and perform the mission that I want it to perform? Then you purchase it, learn the system, and then go fly it. And Newfields and many of the other companies are sort of following those steps. The ones that don't follow those steps end up really causing themselves a lot of concern and a lot of probably misspent money.
What are some of the technical problems that you have seen with unmanned aerial systems in the United States?
Well, the biggest concerns out there from the FAA and the community as a whole is seeing a void or sensing a void. Because in a manned aircraft, the pilot should be able to see another aircraft or hopefully see one and then avoid it. If there's nobody on the aircraft, you still have to avoid the other aircraft. So the technology has been coming along greatly. So that's one of the issues. The other one, believe it or not, is RF, radio frequency, because radio frequencies are limited. Cell phones are eating up bandwidth tremendously, and that causes some issues. If two UAS are operating on the same frequency in a close proximity, there's potential for interference. If you have interference, you don't know how the system's going to react. So those are two of the biggest things. And what we see, and it's coming along greatly, is the young entrepreneurs of today and the young engineers grew up on automation and programming and a lot more software-driven safety features are being put in to these systems. Geofencing to keep it in an area. Geofencing within that area to keep it from running into a house, a building, a tower, power lines, whatever. They have that ability now. Now, not all UAS are the same. That's one of the issues. There are no standards, so it's not like a car where you can go to your garage and build to a standard. And people are trying to force fit UAS into the manned aircraft arena because there are regulations. The difference being is you can't take a 10-pound piece of metal that's required to be 10 pounds to meet a standard and put it into a UAS that's a pound and a half. So the FAA and really the community as a whole, manufacturers, testers, and everybody else, have to really start focusing on those standards, because with the standards will come safety.
I completely agree with you about safety standards and the importance, and I think that's something that not only the general public, but also everyone involved in air traffic is very concerned with the use of unmanned aerial systems. What are some of the social problems that you have seen with unmanned aerial systems in the United States?
Michael, that's probably one of the touchiest subjects out there. And again, the press is there to keep us informed, but oftentimes they are telling a story because they're trying to sell their product. So sometimes it goes a little bit beyond news, or maybe they didn't do their research quite as well as they could have, and they take a wrong perspective. People are worried about being spied upon. But really, when you think about it today, if an unmanned aircraft flies over your property, yes, it can be used to, quote, spy on you. However, that being said, if a helicopter flies over, whether it belongs to the military, a news organization, or anything else, guess what it probably has on it? It probably has a camera. Plus, just look at the Boston Marathon bombing incident. Within 2 hours of that occurring, they had pictures from cameras in stores, on street corners, on tops of buildings, and they had the perpetrators identified. On the unmanned aircraft side, you look at it, and a lot of these sensors, not all of them have cameras, number one. So if they're flying a multispectral, they're not going to be able to see into your backyard and determine what you're doing. And really, the Department of Justice, AUVSRI, and a variety of other organizations are trying to develop ways and procedures and processes to limit how that data can be used. Because really, that's the key. It's not the fact that it was, you know, a real estate guy flew over your backyard and saw you sunbathing nude. Although there has been an incident down in Australia where a real estate agent did that and then put it up on a billboard, not even really looking to see what was there because they were showing the property next door. And the lady was unhappy, and justifiably so. There's many facets of it. It's taking the picture in the first place, the purpose you were up there in the first place, how you deal with the data you've collected, if it's video, if it's pictures, whatever, how you store it. Because hackers today are getting into, if they can get into a big bank, they can probably get into your personal computer at home if you're tied to a network. So those are the things that are being looked at, and most of the laws now are going back to, and what they're looking at is saying, you can take the picture, but you may not be able to use it. If the police are doing a raid on your next door neighbor's house and they see that you have a pot plant growing in your backyard, that's not probable cause, and they cannot use that data to then go in and raid your house type thing. So, but it is a touchy subject, and it's one of those fine lines things where this tool is so valuable as far as UAS goes. Like I say, be it infrastructure, looking at old school buildings that are 3 and 4 stories tall, where the only way you can really do an inspection is to hang a person over the side, lower them down, move them over, raise them back up. Now you've put potentially a life in danger. The same thing with the larger dams. If a UAS can do that with a camera, and it's going to save a life, then it's well worth it.
I think you made two excellent points just now. One is, of course, safety, human life being invaluable. We need to make sure that we're moving constantly towards, with technology, we're moving towards a safer work environment for people, because that's what we need. That's our goal. You also touched on with the realtor in Australia and him not realizing what was in the photo that got put up on the billboard. I think there were, off the top of my head, I can think of 3 points where people should have been having a system of checks in place for something like that. And I think that comes down to due diligence when it comes to it, and cooperation. The realtor should have been paying attention to what he was doing. The person who developed the photograph that went on the billboard should have been seeing that, obviously. And most importantly, the company that put that up on the billboard, because the realtor doesn't own that billboard. Whoever the company that owned that billboard should have noticed what they were putting up before they put it up. And I don't want to go as far as to call it carelessness, but it's definitely a practice in diligence that we all need to be aware of. I would say that through a system of checks and balances, when we're doing these things with unmanned aerial systems and photography for whatever purpose, we need to be aware of what we're doing and the potential dangers that are associated with this, both invasion of privacy and malfunctions with the unmanned aerial systems. Dennis, we're about out of time today, but before I let you go, every once in a while we get some of our listeners who actually write in questions when they find out who we're going to be interviewing in the future. And if you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a question from one of our audience members.
Please.
We selected this question from Marie from Sedona, Arizona. Marie asks, in your opinion, where do you see the future of unmanned aerial systems? Or where would you like to see the future of unmanned aerial systems in our national airspace going?
Marie, that is an excellent question. You know, I don't know how old you are. I'm old enough to remember the Dick Tracy comic books where he looked at his wristwatch and he had a TV and it was a communications device so he could see the person at the other end. When that came out, that was comic. That was fantasy. That was never going to happen. Now you can go down and you can buy a Sony watch or what looks to be a watch and communicate with it, and it sends pictures. Unmanned aircraft are much the same way. When you look at the old sci-fi movies and you see some of the things that's going on, even Star Trek, you know, we're not going to warp speed necessarily, however, right now, if you get on a 757, 80% of that flight is flown by a computer. The pilot is on there in case there's an issue, that he can take over and land the plane safely and save lives and all those types of things. Much like Sullenberger did when his two engines flamed out up there in New York several years ago. I truly believe that even for air travel, I won't get on, and I deal with these systems daily. I won't get on an airplane without a pilot on board. I'm not sure if my son will or not, but I would be willing to bet almost everything I have that his children will, because it'll become the norm. The safety features and the checks and the balances on the software will be much better and able to handle it. Let's face the facts. An airliner, a year and a half or 2 years ago, flying from New York or to Minneapolis or something, when they got somewhere over North Dakota, because the two pilots were up playing on their computers, they had to turn around and go back. Computers normally don't have that problem. So, you know, from that perspective, but then when you look at all the advantages to society that these will have, safety features, looking at infrastructure and everything else, as the technology develops for the seeing of void so that you don't run into things, I just see it blossoming totally. You know, will the skies be dark with UAS? I hope not, because I really enjoy the sun. That's why I live in New Mexico. However, at the same time, it's coming. And that's what we have to work for. And that's one of the FAA's hardest problem. How do you deal with the lanes in the sky that aren't there yet? You know, how do you deal with the technology that really hasn't developed when you're using a system that's a little bit antiquated to do the assessment on this new stuff? And that's part of the issue. They have a very tough job, but that's where I truly see it going in the future.
That's a really interesting perspective, and I think that your perspective is not only shared by myself, but many enthusiasts in the unmanned aerial system community. And I'd like to think that a lot of the general public share that as well. We'll see where it goes over the next few years, and I share your concern about getting on a plane that's completely autonomous. I don't know how I'd feel about that, but perhaps my child or my child's child will have that, but that'll come after safety and technology. Dennis, again, thank you so much for being on the show today. It has been an absolute pleasure. I want to wish you the best of luck, New Mexico State University, the best of luck with all the tests that come out there, and I would love to have you back on the show later on, so we can have an update on how some of the tests have gone at New Mexico State University.
Michael, I'd be happy to be back on the show. And again, I thank you for the efforts that you're doing, because as this is part of that educational process to help the public understand where UAS is, where it's going, and what the issues are. And it goes back to each of us has our own perspective. You know, some people are very for them, some people are dead set against them. But each has a perspective that's not necessarily wrong. It just may be being made without all the information. And shows like this really can make a difference. And thank you again.
Believe me when I say that the pleasure has actually been all on my side. It's been great having you on the show. Thanks again. We'll talk to you soon.
The views and opinions expressed on our podcast are those of the authors, producers, and our guests. They do not automatically reflect the views or opinions of any organization or government agency that are guests on our podcast, nor do they reflect the official policy or position of any U.S. government agency. If you have information that you would like to have discussed on our show or would like to be a guest on our show, please contact us on our website, uas-today.com, or email us at podcast@uas-today.com. Thanks for listening.